The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're really going deep on something absolutely core to, well, to who you are, your memory. But the way we usually think about it, it's almost certainly wrong. We're exploring the fascinating work of cognitive psychologist Jonathan K. Foster.
That's right. And our goal today, really, is to challenge that common idea, you know, that your memory works like a video camera, just recording things, or maybe like a tidy file cabinet.
Right, the storage idea.
Exactly. Foster shows us, and the science backs him up, that memory is much more active. It's dynamic. He describes it almost like a creative artist, constantly interpreting and reconstructing.
I like that creative artist idea, because when you remember something really vividly, it feels so true, so accurate. You feel absolutely certain. Mm-hmm. But Foster's point is that feeling, that confidence, it's often completely separate from whether the memory is actually objectively correct.
And that gap, that disconnect, is why this is so important. I mean, really understanding how flexible, how malleable memory is. It changes things.
How so?
Well, think about eyewitness testimony in court, for instance, or even just how you study effectively, how you learn, and maybe most profoundly, how you actually construct your own sense of self, your identity.
Okay, so accepting these limitations might actually give us more control.
That's the idea. Better control over your own mind, essentially.
All right, let's talk about the person guiding us through this. Jonathan K. Foster, he sounds like quite the authority.
Oh, he definitely is. A leading figure in cognitive psychology and neuropsychology, too. He was at Cambridge for a long time, now at the University of Sydney. His whole career has basically been about untangling how memory works in the brain.
But it's not just lab coats and experiments, is it? There's something more that makes his view unique.
That's the key point, I think. What makes his work so powerful is that he connects the dots between the hard science, the neuroscience, the cognitive models, and the real world. The clinical side.
Clinical, you mean working with patients.
Exactly. He's worked directly with people suffering from really severe memory problems, amnesia, dementia, things like that.
Yeah.
So he hasn't just studied memory abstractly. He's seen firsthand what happens when it breaks down, the impact on people's lives, their sense of self.
Wow. Okay.
That experience, that clinical perspective, it brings a kind of necessary humanity to the science. It makes it relatable and accurate.
That really sets the stage. Okay, so let's get to the heart of it.
Yeah.
If memory isn't just storage, what is it doing? What's the core idea?
The central argument from Foster is that memory is fundamentally a reconstructive process. It's not passive retrieval.
Reconstructive, meaning?
Meaning every time you remember something, you're not just pulling up an old file. Mm. You're actively rebuilding that past experience, often using just fragments, bits and pieces of information.
Okay, that sounds a little unsettling, maybe, but also unsettling. So that rebuilding process must be influenced by, well, everything that's happened since, right?
Precisely. Your current mood, the situation you're in right now, all the new things you've learned, your expectations, it all shapes how you reconstruct that past event. The past isn't fixed. It's kind of constantly being edited.
So here's the tricky part, then. If it's always being rebuilt and we know it can be inaccurate, why does remembering feel so real, so certain? That feeling is incredibly strong.
Yeah, that's the paradox Foster really digs into. And his answer is fascinating. He argues that these imperfections, these errors in memory, aren't necessarily design flaws. Often they're actually adaptive features.
Adaptive? How can errors be adaptive?
Well, things like forgetting details or generalizing from past experiences or reconstructing events, these can be really useful for survival, for making quick decisions, for navigating the future. Evolution, you could say, prioritize the system that's fast and useful over one that's perfectly accurate about the past.
Okay, so the errors help us function better now and in the future.
In many ways, yes. The whole book kind of guides you through understanding these adaptive errors.
Let's dive into one of the classic studies he uses to show this reconstruction idea in action. Sir Frederick Bartlett's War of the Ghosts study.
Ah, yes. A cornerstone study. It was done way back in 1932, but still so relevant. Bartlett had British participants read this Native American folktale, The War of the Ghosts.
And the story was deliberately unfamiliar, right?
Exactly. It had cultural elements, plot points, supernatural stuff that just didn't fit the participants' own cultural background, their expectations, what psychologists call their schemas.
So these unfamiliar bits were the parts that got distorted when they tried to remember it later.
Systematically distorted. When Bartlett asked them to recall the story, sometimes weeks or months later, people left out the confusing parts. They rationalized things that didn't make sense to them. They changed phrases to sound more familiar, more British, basically.
So they weren't remembering the story as it was told?
No, they were rebuilding it to fit their way of understanding the world, their existing mental framework.
So, if I think about, say, an argument I had with someone last week, my brain isn't playing back a recording of exactly what they said.
Probably not. It's more likely retrieving fragments, maybe the emotional tone, a key phrase or two, and then filling in the gaps based on your existing relationship, your expectations, what makes sense to you now.
You're telling a story that fits your current understanding.
That's a great way to put it. And this leads right into another key idea Foster explores. Memory isn't just one thing. It's not monolithic. It's more like a family of different systems working together, a multi-system architecture.
Okay, break that down for us. What are the main types of memory we should know about?
The big distinction is usually made between explicit memory and implicit memory. Explicit is the conscious stuff, things you know, and can deliberately recall, sometimes called declarative memory.
Right, the I remember when or I know that stuff.
Exactly. And that splits into two important types. First, episodic memory. That's your personal autobiography. Memories of specific events tied to a time and place, like remembering what you had for breakfast this morning or your 16th birthday party.
Your life story, basically.
Right. And second, semantic memory. This is your general knowledge about the world, facts, concepts, language. Knowing that Paris is the capital of France or what a dog is or the rules of grammar, it's not tied to a specific personal experience.
Okay, explicit memory, episodic and semantic. Got it. What about implicit memory then?
Implicit memory is the unconscious stuff. It influences our behavior without us having to consciously think about it. The main type here is procedural memory.
Procedures, like skills.
Exactly. Skills and habits. Riding bike, tying your shoelaces, playing a musical instrument. You can do these things often very well, but you might struggle to consciously explain every single step involved. The knowledge is embedded in the action itself.
You just know how to do it.
Right. It doesn't require conscious retrieval in the same way remembering your birthday does.
And the evidence that these systems really are separate, that comes from some quite dramatic clinical cases, doesn't it? Like patient HM.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. The case of HM, Henry Molaison, is probably one of the most important in the history of memory research. It really changed everything.
What happened to him?
He had surgery for severe epilepsy, and unfortunately, it involved removing parts of his hippocampus, a brain structure crucial for memory. The tragic result was profound anterograde amnesia.
Anterograde amnesia. Can you unpack that term a bit?
Sure. Antero means forward. So, anterograde amnesia is the inability to form new explicit memories after the brain injury occurred. He couldn't transfer new conscious information, facts, events from his short-term awareness into long-term storage.
So he could remember his past before the surgery?
Yes. His childhood, his life up to that point was largely intact. But after the surgery, he could meet someone, have a conversation, and 5 minutes after they left the room, he'd have no recollection of ever meeting them. He lived perpetually in the present moment. It was devastating.
But, and this is the crucial part for understanding the different systems, his implicit memory wasn't affected in the same way.
Exactly. That was the mind-blowing discovery. His procedural memory remained intact. He could learn new motor skills. For instance, researchers taught him a task called mirror drawing, where you trace a shape while only looking at its reflection. It's tricky.
I've tried that. It's hard.
Right. And HM got better at it. Day after day, just like anyone else would. But here's the kicker. Every time they brought the task out, he'd claim he'd never seen it before and had no memory of ever doing it.
Wow. So his hands learned, but his conscious mind didn't record the learning experience.
Precisely. It was definitive proof that the brain uses separate systems for conscious recall of facts and events, explicit, versus learned skills and habits, implicit. The hippocampus seems crucial for forming those new explicit memories, but not for procedural learning.
Okay, this connects to another idea you mentioned about forgetting. We usually think of forgetting as just failure, a bad thing. But Foster sees it differently.
He really does. He argues that forgetting isn't the enemy of memory. It's more like its essential partner. It's adaptive. Think about HM. His tragedy was not being able to form new memories. But imagine the opposite problem. Someone who couldn't forget.
That sounds like it could be just as bad in a different way, like being overwhelmed.
Exactly. And Foster discusses the famous case of Solomon Sharashevsky, often just called S. He was studied by a Russian neuropsychologist for decades. S seemed to have a virtually limitless memory, possibly aided by a condition called synesthesia.
Synesthesia? That's where senses get mixed up, right? Like hearing colors or tasting shapes.
Yeah, something like that. For S, information came with this incredibly rich, multi-sensory detail. Sounds had colors, words had textures, numbers had personalities, and because it was so vivid, everything stuck.
So he remembered everything. Sounds like a superpower.
You'd think so, but it was actually a profound handicap. His mind was incredibly cluttered with trivial details, the exact tone of voice someone used years ago, the pattern on their shirt, the temperature of the room.
Oh, the noise.
All the noise. And because he couldn't filter it out, he found it incredibly difficult to think abstractly, to generalize, to grasp the bigger picture.
Yeah.
He couldn't see the forest for the millions of individual leaves, each perfectly remembered.
So forgetting is like the brain's decluttering mechanism. Its editing process.
That's a perfect way to put it. It prunes the irrelevant stuff so we can focus on what matters, make connections, and function efficiently. Forgetting is crucial for adaptive cognition.
Okay, let's try to pull together some of the biggest themes from all this, the major takeaways. What's theme number one?
I think maybe the most powerful and maybe unsettling one is this. Your feeling of confidence about a memory is a really poor guide to how accurate it actually is.
Oof, yeah. That vivid feeling of knowing you're right.
It can feel absolutely certain, even when the memory has been significantly reconstructed, maybe even contains major inaccuracies. The emotional intensity just isn't linked reliably to objective truth.
So the practical takeaway there is humility. Like in an argument about what happened last year, realizing that both you and the other person could be completely sincere, feel totally confident, and yet both be misremembering parts of it.
Exactly. It encourages a bit more caution and empathy when recollections differ. Okay, theme two. Memory isn't really about preserving the past. It's primarily about navigating the future.
That reframes its whole purpose, doesn't it?
Completely. It didn't evolve to be a perfect historical archive. It evolved to help us predict, plan, and survive future situations. It's maybe more like a simulator, running scenarios based on past experiences, often edited or generalized experiences, to help guide future actions.
So errors, like generalizing from a past mistake instead of remembering every tiny detail of it, might actually be useful for future decision making.
Potentially, yes. The system is biased towards utility, not perfect fidelity. And theme three, which is huge. Memory is the absolute bedrock of our personal identity.
Our sense of self.
Yes. Who you are, your life story, your continuous sense of being the same person, over time, it's all constructed from your memories, particularly those episodic personal memories.
Which is why memory disorders like Alzheimer's are so devastating. It's not just forgetting facts.
It's the erosion of the self, the shattering of that personal narrative. It highlights just how fundamental memory is to our very being.
Foster uses some really striking phrases to capture these ideas. I love the main metaphor about reconstruction.
Oh, the paleontologist one?
Yeah. Memory is not a video recording of experience, but a paleontologist's reconstruction of a dinosaur from a few scattered bones.
It's so vivid, isn't it? It really drives home that idea of active construction. The paleontologist finds fragments, right? And then uses their existing knowledge, their schemas about dinosaur anatomy, to fill in the massive gaps and build a plausible whole.
Our brain is doing that constantly with memory fragments.
Exactly. And then there's the one about forgetting.
Forgetting is not the opposite of remembering. It is remembering's partner in the dance of adaptive cognition.
I like that one too. It emphasizes that forgetting isn't a failure. It's part of the normal, healthy process. It's the partner that allows remembering to function effectively without being overwhelmed. The cognitive filter.
And maybe the most thought-provoking one, linking memory and identity. We are who we are largely because of what we remember, but what we remember is largely a fiction.
Yeah, that one definitely makes you pause because our personal narrative feels so real, so authentic. But understanding the reconstructive nature forces you to accept that its authenticity is, in a way, manufactured by the brain.
It's a constructed truth, not a recorded one?
Precisely. A powerful idea to sit with.
Okay, so bringing this down to earth, how can we use this understanding in our everyday lives? Like, if memory is reconstructive, how does that change how we should try to learn things?
Well, Foster's work points to some clear evidence-based strategies. The big shift is away from passive methods, just rereading your notes, for example. It feels productive because the material becomes familiar.
Familiarity, but that's not the same as actually knowing it, right?
Exactly. Familiarity is a trap. It doesn't mean you can actually reconstruct the information yourself when needed. So you need active methods.
Like what?
The number one technique is active recall, basically self-testing. Constantly quiz yourself. Try to retrieve the information from your own mind without looking at the source material.
Why is that so much better?
Because it forces your brain to practice the very act of reconstruction you'll need to perform later, like in an exam or when you need the information on the job. You're strengthening the retrieval pathways.
Okay, active recall. What else?
Spaced repetition. Don't cram. Spreading out your study sessions over time is far more effective. Each time you retrieve the memory, after a bit of forgetting is set in, you reconsolidate it, making it stronger. Consolidation needs time and sleep.
Ah, sleep. That's important, too.
Crucial. We'll come back to that. And for complex stuff, mnemonics can help techniques like the method of loci, building a memory palace. Memory loves structure, narrative, and vivid imagery.
Right. And beyond learning, you mentioned implications for the justice system earlier.
Yes. Huge implications. Especially for eyewitness testimony. Knowing how easily memories can be distorted, even unintentionally, by leading questions, by how lineups are presented, means the legal system needs procedures that minimize that contamination.
Because a witness can be incredibly confident, yet sincerely mistaken.
Absolutely. Confidence, as we said, is not a reliable indicator of accuracy. Double-blind lineups, careful interviewing techniques, these are critical.
And finally, just for everyday brain health and memory function, what are the basics Foster emphasizes?
It really boils down to fundamentals we often neglect. Number one, adequate sleep. So much memory consolidation, the process of making memories stable and long-lasting, happens while you sleep, particularly during deep sleep. Skimping on sleep directly impairs memory.
Non-negotiable, then.
Pretty much. And number two, regular exercise. It's not just good for your body. It promotes overall brain health, blood flow, reduces stress, all of which creates a better environment for memory systems to function optimally.
Sleep and exercise. Simple, but powerful.
Okay, reflecting on all this. What's the biggest takeaway for you? What really sticks?
For me, I think it's that commitment to a healthy skepticism about my own memory. Just understanding that my recall isn't perfect, that it's interpretive. It leads to, I hope, a bit more humility, especially in disagreements, more willingness to listen and consider that my version might not be the whole story.
Yeah, the humility point is big. Mm. For me, the most surprising and actually quite empowering idea is that we are active constructors of our past. It sounds a bit strange, but it means the past isn't totally fixed. We can look back at old events with new understanding, new context.
And reframe the narrative.
Exactly. We can reinterpret and reconstruct our understanding of past events, which can actually change how they affect us now.
Yeah.
That feels hopeful in a way. Less like we're trapped by the past.
That's a really insightful way to look at it. It turns the reconstructive nature from a potential flaw into a potential strength.
A really fascinating deep dive. Challenging stuff, but incredibly important for understanding ourselves. Absolutely. A pleasure to discuss it.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.